Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, Matt, here we are, the two Matts.
And why? Why are we here?
Well, fuck knows.
It's one of the mysteries, isn't it? I think it's because the New European 7 years ago was founded.
It was.
And you are the Nick Fury. You have to tell the super... You know, the founder of the Avengers, mate.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Right? You have to tell the superhero origin story.
Right. Okay, well, here's the origin story. 7 years ago, on the 24th of June, I was walking through London on a beautiful day and everybody was depressed. Why were they depressed? Because Britain had just voted to leave the European Union. And frankly, I don't think anyone could believe it. And it did occur to me that overnight there had been this enormous new constituency of people called the 48%, who were all pissed off and didn't really have any single media that spoke exactly to this singularity that had caused such kind of bemusement and anger. And I thought, why don't we launch a new national newspaper? And incredibly, I was supported by the company I was working for at the time. And we launched the New European 9 days later. As a pop-up, we thought it would last 4 issues. 7 years later, we're going strong. Circulation is going really well. We've had our best couple of months of subscriptions for a long time. So I think, you know, I've lived with a certain weird kind of guilt for the last 7 years, having been one of very few people to have come out smiling from Brexit. But, you know, generally, I appreciate it's been a shit show for everybody else.
And I guess with this podcast, what we're trying to, and I say this is a very recent and fortunate addition to the new European team, try and take some of that ethos of not just being anti-Brexit, but, you know, fiercely opposed to the nationalistic direction that politics is taking.
Yeah, politics and media, I would say.
And also, I think probably both of us somewhat antagonized by the earnestness of a lot of podcasting. Yeah. To try and look at it in that way and, you know, hopefully add some value to the audio landscape.
I hope so. What are we going to call this episode, Matt?
What a happy day.
What about the depths of despair?
Angry centrist.
Angry centrist.
Angry centrist has it. So, which is what we are.
Yeah.
There's no point in denying it.
Because there's a massive gap in the podcast market.
Well, actually, I think there may be a gap for angry centrists, right? There's a lot of very somber and...
No, but these guys, these podcast reviewers, they always... And they can't say the word centrist without putting angry before it.
At best.
Yeah.
I mean, there are plenty of other epithets. We are, I believe, as the kids say, this podcast is dropping. On the day of the 7th anniversary of the decision to leave the EU.
Is it though? It's not. It's tomorrow, isn't it? The 23rd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's right, Matt. That is indeed.
That's right, Matt. The miracle of recording technology.
He's
had a hard day. He's been, for reasons we'll explain later, he's a little bit tired. Don't worry. But we're going to have to talk about the anniversary, Brexit, where we are now. And we promise, we're not going to talk every week about Brexit, but I think it would be eccentric not to talk about it.
It would.
The other big story, of course, is...
The submarine.
It has been really dominant. And I think there are things we want to talk about.
The submarine and the contrast with that terrible tragedy last week in the Mediterranean where 700 people died.
Yeah. And then, of course, there are some wrap-up issues like the all-important cage fight between Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, which...
The story of the month.
We must get into.
Great. So this is episode 1 of The Two Matts.
the angry centrists.
So, Matt, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, I think we've got to talk about the 7th anniversary of Brexit, haven't we?
Is it 7 years
already? It is 7 years. And to quote Eddie Murphy in Trading Places, what a happy day. You know, if you're the satellites can see the conga sort of marching round the Red Wall. There are days, there are prayers of gratitude being given in places of worship.
Yeah.
I gather
bells tolling.
The NHS is awash with, you know, grateful nurses and doctors thanking, you know, Prime Minister for the 350 million extra a week.
That's right.
But in back, in the real world,
it's shit.
It has been, I mean, you know, an unmitigated disaster.
I was trying to think. I mean, genuinely, obviously, we're from the New European, so we've hated it from day one. And that view has not changed. But is there anything positive, I mean, objectively, that you could say, well, all right, at least, you know, it's delivered, aside from blue passports?
No, I mean, I sort of keep an open mind to sort of, hey, is there going to be some at least tiny silver lining that I haven't spotted? And I cannot spot it.
It seems like unmitigated bad news, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, now we've shifted from is it good or bad to why is it bad? So I think you and I would agree that it's bad because it's a stupid idea. Whereas that very memorable moment in May when Nigel Farage said Brexit has failed, he's blaming it on the Conservative Party, the Conservative government, and saying it's a betrayal. And I think the betrayal narrative will be now the what you hear from the right and the Brexiteer wing, which is it's all the fault of either the Conservative Party, or if you're the Conservative government, of the Blob, the BBC,
Remainers,
yoga instructors, Pisceans,
toffee eating, whatever it was she said,
whatever it is, you know, the Anti-Growth Coalition was my personal favourite. I mean, I don't know where they are now, whether they still meet or whether they've
shrunk,
whether they've disbanded. But I mean, that will be, in a way, that will be the new division. Will be why do you think Brexit is rubbish?
And I mean.
My kind of take on it all, and I've written a piece in the special issue of the New European to mark this glorious anniversary, is that obviously there are, you know, we can all reel out economic statistics that show that it's been very bad for the country, but it isn't just that. I mean, I think Brexit has debased public life, which is very ironic because it was meant to be. I mean, it was sold as this great boost for the public sector, 350 million quid a week extra for the NHS, you know, the left behinds finally being noticed and so on. And actually what you've seen is a kind of hollowing out of public life. It's no serious policy and a very debased political culture.
But do you think that we were just unlucky that we happened to have a wave of shit politicians around the time?
But I think even if there'd been talented politicians, and after all, not all the politicians who've been involved in Brexit are without ability. I mean, Michael Gove, you know, he's wrong about Brexit, but he's a clever guy.
Yeah. But to demonstrate how far things have fallen, Theresa May now looks kind of, you know, like an inspirational leader.
This is true. But the dynamics of Brexit, I think, have driven us to a place where we've now had four lousy prime ministers on the trot. You know, Park Cameron for the moment. You know, we've had Theresa May, we've had Boris Johnson, we've had Liz Truss, and now Rishi Sunak. I thought the debate on the Privileges Committee report on Johnson's lying to the House of Commons about the COVID rules breaches in Downing Street was one of the most depressing things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing. There were some good speeches. Theresa May was good. Penny Mordaunt was good. Tobias Elwood, who's written for... excellent. I'm talking about the Tory side.
Yeah.
But just watching it and the how conspicuous Rishi Sunak's absence was, because this was an opportunity to sort of mark a break with the Boris era, with the kind of Brexit chaos era. I'm not saying it would have been successful, but it was screaming out to be done. And Sunak had in his hand a 106-page report from the Privileges Committee saying that Johnson had lied, and knowingly so. You know, so he had ammo.
Yeah.
But the briefing from Number 10 was, we don't want to, quote, poke the beast. Mm. And, of course, the upshot of that is that the beast, Boris Johnson, now knows that he can intimidate the sitting prime minister whenever he wants. And in that debate, there was a very powerful speech by Caroline Lucas about how, who was a Green MP who's very sadly standing down in the next election, about the guilt of the Tories who stayed away.
It was a brilliant speech. Can we get, I don't know if we can ask producer Matt, have we got a clip of that?
Does she agree with me that those members of this House who seem to think that abstention is an appropriate response to this debate are wholly wrong, that this debate goes to the very heart of the democratic principles on which our democracy is founded, and that therefore it is, for those people who are abstaining, they are guilty not just of cowardice, but of complicity with the very contempt for which Boris Johnson has been found responsible.
Yeah. I mean, he is terminally debased, but Sunak is still scared of him, because Sunak is prime minister at the whim of his MPs and members. And, I mean, I think he's crazy to be so frightened of Boris, but he is. And you know, Johnson now has this bully pulpit and a weekly column in, you guessed it, the Daily Mail.
Yeah.
And that will be read with terror in Number 10.
Yeah, except that he's writing about, you know, midnight refrigerators and stuff like this.
Yeah, he is now. But, I mean, let's wait and see. I mean, I agree with you. I think that, you know, the Johnson era is over, and Sunak should acknowledge that. But the fact, I guess the point I'm making is that the fact that he didn't tells you a lot about Brexit culture.
Yeah. Or is it Tory culture? Because,
well,
they're almost synonymous, aren't they? I mean, whole...
they are now.
Brexit was a conservative solution to a conservative problem, and that turned into a national disaster.
Yeah, it was. Why was there a referendum? Because the Tory party for decades hadn't been able to flush the European issue out of its system. The referendum went the wrong way for Cameron and has led to 7 years of absolute mayhem. It is a conservative issue, and you know what one hopes is that, looking ahead to the general election, that there will, I think, be a change, and that change enables people to start looking at our relationship with the EU in a way that isn't just relitigating 2016.
Yeah, it's got to be. In fact, it's very interesting. People, obviously, you know, this is something we think about at the New European a lot because we're angry centrists.
Yes.
As that goes, the guy at the Times.
It's a good t-shirt, actually.
Angry centrists.
Angry old centrists.
So you can't be a centrist without being angry these days, apparently, except that I'm not really that angry about anything
these days. I'm quite chuffed at the angry centrist label, because I thought the centrist label was kind of a bit like, you know, prior to palliative care.
Yeah.
Really. You know, sort of, it's your last, yeah, all right, yeah. You can be a centrist.
But, you know, like, I remember somebody saying about, you know, this myth about being in the middle, about being the centrist, about being somehow wishy-washy or, you know, ineffective or bleeding heart liberals or whatever. But it is true that we've been battling recently two extremes that are deeply reactionary. You know, you've got the hard left that was represented by Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
You had the Boris Johnson hard right and Liz Truss even further economically. And they absolutely crashed everything that they touched, you know. So I think there's a great case for saying it's the centre where stuff actually gets done, you know, and centrism shouldn't be the slur some people think it is.
No, of course not. And at the very least, I think saying I'm not either Nigel Farage or Jeremy Corbyn is not something you should be ashamed of saying.
No, that's right, that's right.
I mean, there's a great tendency in the era of social media to dismiss by label. So, you know, and centrist dad is funny and boomer is funny, but it actually doesn't advance anything very far. It doesn't get you. I mean, it doesn't have any content to it.
Yeah.
It's just a form of dismissal.
Talking of social media, I mean, my belief is that it's an entirely parallel universe and actually bears very little reflection to the real world. And I wonder whether that's also true of Brexit itself as an issue. Is it just people like us and people who listen to The Rest Is Politics and buy the New European and read The Guardian ferociously? You know, is it just people like that who are wound up by this? Or do you think there is still a real sense of, my God, what has happened? Is there a sense of bemusement in the real world out there? You know, in bus stops in Stockport, are they having these kind of conversations?
Well, what I doubt is that they're having conversations about Brexit, named as such. But I think they're definitely having conversations about its consequences. Mm. And I think, to your original question, as you know, I'm a bit obsessed by multiverses and all that.
Yeah.
I do think that one of the things that that's happened in the last 7 years is that there's sort of been a hole ripped in the space-time continuum and a whole new alternate reality has kind of entered, in which Suella Braverman is Home Secretary, in which it's okay, the Tories think, to sort of train their guns, metaphorically if not literally, although some of them want to do it literally, on small boats, you know, on which Boris Johnson thinks it's fine to lie, on which, you know, the Conservative Party generally, we all saw that Mirror video of the ghastly party in December 2020 at Conservative headquarters, think it's fine to party while the rest of the country can't even go and see its loved ones in, you know, on their deathbeds during the pandemic. And I think that there are that the sense that the kind of basic kind of glue of a society, which is at least politically speaking, which is truth and trust, that those values have been really seriously corroded by Brexit. Yeah.
Why can't Keir Starmer stand up and say, looking at the polls, listening to everybody, even with, notwithstanding the red wall that he seems to be living in fear of, and just say, look, it's obvious that this is shit. It's obvious. There's no two ways about it. We've made a mistake, okay? We've made a mistake and we need to apply a corrective course, and I'm going to demonstrate by showing leadership and saying some things that some people will find unpopular, but I'm going to make the case for why Britain needs to take these steps to redress the balance in our relationship to the European Union. He doesn't even have to say we're going to rejoin, but has to say something more fundamental than I'm going to make Brexit work.
Yeah, I think make Brexit work is now sort of running out of sustainability as a lie.
But why doesn't he just say Brexit's not going to work because it never could work?
I think the problem is, you know, it relates to a point I just made about not relitigating 2016. There is a terror in the Labour Party of appearing to go back to 7 years ago. I think that what Labour, and indeed all parties, you know, who are not held in this kind of Brexit trap, need to start thinking about is, okay, what is the positive road that leads in time to rejoining, and what would be the first phase of arguing that? And yeah, I'd love to hear Starmer before the election. You know, what I really want to hear is, what sort of country are we going to be that seeks application to join the EU?
Yeah,
because it's going to be a very different situation to what it was when we joined, you know, in the 70s, and actually a very different situation to when we left, or we voted to leave, in 2016. I think that Labour is traumatised by the thought that it will lose the election if it appears to be annoying its voters who voted for Brexit. You know the script. I think it's too frightened of that.
Right.
But I would certainly want to see Starmer, between now and polling day, you know, be enthusiastically pro-European and not. I mean, we'll make Brexit work is a stupid. It's actually a stupid
line.
Because I think we've established that you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me is the bleak takeaway from the 7th anniversary is that, you know, there are no trade deals. It's walloping growth. It's walloping trade in terms of friction between different countries. It's made our relationship with Northern Ireland incredibly complicated. You know, the list is endless. Yeah. In particular, it's had a desperate effect on the labour market. And so it begs really unanswerable questions for Labour, which is, all right, well, how would you make Brexit work? And there is no answer to that. So I hope that they replace that silly slogan between now and polling. I really do.
The question to ask him, I think, is the question that they used to ask about digital in journalism, about if there was a big red button on your desk and you could press it and make the internet go away, would you press it? And every publisher in the country would have said 100%, right? Yeah. Question someone should ask Keir Starmer is, if there was a big red button on the desk of number 10 when you get in and you can press it and we go back to pre-Brexit, would you press it?
Yeah, and if he doesn't say yes, I mean,
in a heartbeat. You'd have to question his sanity.
I mean, one of the things that Sunak has shown is that he's a weak and fearful leader. And I think that there is room for... I mean, I was very impressed when Starmer said over the COVID breaches allegations, if they find me in breach, I'll step down.
Yeah.
Right? I thought that was a good moment, a good non-electoral milestone. I think if he answered anything but truthfully to the question you just posed, Matt, I would think much less of him. But this is, you know, this is something I think we're going to be talking about a lot between now and the election, which is, I think Labour has to be a change-making party as well as a safety-first party. You know, they're radically different objectives, but it cannot just aim to win the election by letting the Tories lose it. That never is enough.
And just before we go to a break, one thing I'd like to say, because people, you know, quite often look at the New European and say that we're some sort of mouthpiece for the European Union. If the UK was ever to go back into the European Union, the European Union has got a lot of changing to do in its attitude.
Of course.
And they were culpable in our exit, without doubt. And, you know, if those guys had been able to see the consequences of that time they sent Cameron back home with nothing, I think that should be a very salutary lesson to the European Union about how they look at the UK as well for any future partnership. So it's not without, we're not without strength in our argument with the European Union. We shouldn't consider ourselves to be some supplicant nation begging to get back in. We're still, and can be and should be, right at the heart of it as a very powerful deal maker, and still all the great advantages we had, but the bridge to Europe, you know, that all of that great stuff is obtainable again. But we've just got to recognise that some of the things that membership of the European Union came with are either necessary or desirable, you know, the freedom of movement and all of that stuff, freedom to work, freedom to go and live in Spain, you know, if you want to do that, fantastic, you know, not to have to queue up for half a mile to get into Geneva Airport as I had to do the other week, you know, all of this stuff is a positive. It's not a negative as it was painted during the
no audience. And I think that, you know, never let a crisis go to waste, and we are in a state of perma-crisis really now in this country. And I think one of the things that you can do in a crisis is try and change the narrative, change the paradigm. And at some point, and preferably before the election, at a pinch afterwards, Starmer is going to have to explain how his government is more than just a sort of not Sunak, not Johnson.
Yeah.
That's not enough.
Yeah.
You know, not being the last lot, that runs out of road after about 6 weeks.
That's correct.
People start saying, well, what does this do for the price of biscuits, you know?
Yeah. Great. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and we're going to talk about that dreadful tragedy of the submersible and another tragedy
dreadful
that went without so much comment. So see you in a minute.
Absolutely.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The new European subscribers love us. Some of them have written to me saying we've helped preserve their sanity in the last 7 years, and we've given them something even more important than great journalism. We've given them hope. And counter to all the predictions of the mainstream media who said we'd never last, the new European is thriving. We are one of, maybe even the fastest growing new media titles in Europe. So I've put together a special offer just for listeners of this podcast to join us and help support our work in making the press and politics a better place for us all. You can subscribe to the New European for as little as £1 a week. That buys you complete access to all our journalism online and on our app, including our terrific array of interactive puzzles updated every day and our full 7-year archive. And if, like me, you enjoy getting the actual newspaper delivered through your door, you can have that every week for just another £1 a week. These are the best prices available anywhere. And as a special introduction, I'm going to give all new subscribers a £25 gift voucher absolutely free to be spent at our shop with its great range of t-shirts, hoodies, gifts and our best-selling Bollocks to Brexit passport cover. So do something positive about the mess this country's in and support our journalism. Go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, MATTS. Thank you. Okay, welcome back to the 2 Mats. And Matt, I obviously, the story of the week has been this dreadful tragedy over the wreck of the Titanic. And this, you know, this very human story, this submersible. And, you know, who knows what's happened. And, you know, by the time this comes out, maybe there'll be an answer to that. Although I very much doubt it, because I'll be honest with you, from the very off, I thought this is mission impossible. You know, I mean, it took 35 years to find the bloody Titanic itself, you know, 35 years to find the wreck of the Titanic. So how they would find this tiny needle in a haystack, and then, you know, how you'd lift it to the surface or whatever. So anyway, we don't know what's happened. It's very tragic. But the point that I think is being made increasingly, and I've felt this for a couple of days, is the almost obscene amount of coverage that this story has got when you compare it to a tragedy that happened last week in the Mediterranean, where 700 people, and by the way, that's half of the number of people who were lost in the Titanic, right? Half, 700 people, more or less, have drowned. They don't know, because they don't, obviously there's no manifest, there's no charter, but 700 people, more or less, are thought to have drowned in the Mediterranean. And it didn't make a single front page. The news of it came and went. 100 kids in the hold drowned.
And the Pakistani migrants, apparently systematically sent into the hold.
Yeah.
So they had a lesser chance of,
I mean, just
getting out alive. I mean, it is horrific. The Greek Coast Guard behaving in a very peculiar way.
So lots of suspicion now around, was the Greek Coast Guard involved in something that has inadvertently caused this ship to sink?
I mean, actually, there's more journalism to be done on that subject than there is on the Titanic. But there's been something a bit grotesque about the close to relish, I have to say, about the way in which everyone has been kind of piling in to cover every single detail of this Titanic story. You know, you can hear the podcast, 19-part podcast series being commissioned, Ron Howard preparing his movie, I'm afraid. Yeah. And it's, I think it's partly something that, you know, we've talked about, you know, off air in the past, about the way in which everything is being subsumed into the entertainment industry now. And because, you know, the people on board the sub are extremely wealthy, you know, there have been profiles galore. You know, one of them is a friend of the king and was very active in the Prince's Trust. And the other day on Mail Online, the top 10 items.
Yes, yeah, we're all
the
about
the top 10 yeah. were all about this.
Yeah.
Now, okay, there's a sort of resonance in anything involving the Titanic, but underpinning this, there is a kind of sense that I'm afraid that there isn't an equality of worth between the people who are lost in the Mediterranean and these people.
And in the news cycle, let's be frank about this, in the news cycle, there never has been an equality of worth. You know, there used to be a very cynical measure of what the value of a story was on a popular newspaper, you know, and if it was two people killed in a car crash, you know, in London, that was worth 2,000 killed in a flood in Bangladesh. You know, they were the comparable merits of people's interest, you know, and don't forget, these judgments are based on what people are interested in. But this is the point of my bemusement, or that's not strong enough, my real sort of depression, actually, about what does it mean about us when we can't humanize 100 kids locked in the hold of a boat to the extent that it can't hold our attention for more than a couple of minutes, you know, whereas five very wealthy people in a sub can hold our attention for a week.
Well, I mean, there is something, it goes back to the sort of nose pressed to the glass phenomenon that's always been part of media culture. And I think that shows how unmoored we are morally, but also how I think part of it is that the whole issue with migrants and their sort of fate on the seas, and thousands of them have died already in the Mediterranean this year.
Tens of thousands over the last few years.
It's an extraordinary phenomenon. And there's a great book, actually, by Sally Hayden called My Fourth Time We Drowned, which won the Orwell Prize, which is all about this. And just, if you read that, it's kind of heartbreakingly brilliantly reported. But it leaves you with a sense of how under-assessed this is as a big ethical challenge. I think, in a way, the deep subconscious answer to your question is that we have no way of dealing with the scale of this.
Do you think? I'm not sure.
I mean, we do in terms of, we could.
I think we dealt with the scale of the Titanic when 1,400 died. We're still talking about that 110 years later.
But in the end, I don't mean us personally, you know.
But I mean culturally.
Culturally.
We have the capacity. But I tell you what I think the difference is, and I think it's the media's fault, is that we don't humanize.
Yes.
We don't tell their stories at all. Do you remember that when Amal Rajan was editor of The Independent? And funnily enough, it was going back to 2015, I think. There was that little boy, 2-year-old boy.
Yes.
I think his name, Alan Kurdi. And he was a Syrian refugee, I believe. And he was drowned, washed up dead on a beach. And there was an amazing, there were a couple of photographs and most of the paper, everybody did it on the front page, bizarrely, because it was a little kid, you know, and people could see
child.
It. And Amol, editing The Independent, was the only person to use the real, the best photo, obviously the best photo, which is where you could see this kid's face.
Right.
And it had this Coast Guard or this Turkish, it was on a Turkish beach. And it had this Turkish policeman looking down at this kid in this most pitiful pose, you know, and obviously drowned, awful. And a delicate little headline underneath, which just said, somebody's child. And that, to me, was what we don't do enough of in media, is try and ask people to just think for a minute, try to empathise for 2 or 3 minutes about why the hell these people have made this journey from Pakistan and found themselves on this obscenely overloaded boat. You know, why would you do that? Why would you put your kid into that? There's an answer, and we don't give the answer.
Well, you know, the standard sort of escape is the old Stalin line that one death is a tragedy. I think he was 25 million is statistic. But actually, it isn't a statistic. It's 25 million tragedies. Yeah. And every single person lost on that trawler was someone's son, father, daughter, child, you know, any number of connections. Yeah. And each of them was a world that's been lost. And it's interesting, actually, because I was delving around a bit, and oddly enough, the American media has been better at doing case studies of people who are lost in the Greek disaster than the UK media, which, as far as I can see,
it's dropped the story completely. The New York Times has been on it all the time.
Has been on it,
but the UK media seems to have dropped it,
which is
incredible.
Which is striking when you think that there should be an obvious resonance, because how vessels fare crossing the Channel is now a third rail issue in British politics.
Well, so in my without wanting to blow my own trumpet around something so awful. But when those 27 people died in that boat that went down in the middle of the night in the Channel, we spent, on the New European, we spent months collating every single one of their stories. And we went back all the way and we got their journeys and we got photographs from their home. We found out what they were, why they were doing it. And honestly, I mean, it was a 10,000 word piece with huge photograph. I mean, it was a fantastic piece of journalism. Yeah, and we did the front page of the 27. And I honestly believe, because I do believe in people's goodness generally, if people could see who those 27 people were and understand their stories, and they weren't what, you know, whatever people have got in their heads about this mass of people trying to invade.
It's just a grift.
It's just all of this stuff. It was the opposite of that. Yes. You know, the absolute opposite. These were decent people with just an aspiration. Many of them had people living over here already and were just trying to reach their husbands, but were frustrated by being able to get over by all the bloody bureaucracy that had been deliberately put in place. If people could see the faces and just spend only 5 minutes to try and understand who they were, what their names were, what they were trying to achieve, I think it would be transformative. But there's something about us that, as a race, we want to swerve that and we'd rather talk about these billionaires. You know,
I mean, I tell you what, we're going to have to learn how to write quick, because if we look sort of ahead at the decades to come, there's going to be a lot more migration rather than a lot less. There's going to be climate-propelled migration, not to speak of migration out of war zones and so on. And to sort of circle back to where we started in a way, you know, it's not small boats.
It's people, not boats.
But which is why the slogan "small boats" is part of a dehumanisation narrative that is really, I think, un-British.
Yeah,
and I retain enough optimism to believe it will not last forever.
I think that's right.
The reason it won't last is because of human agency. There's no pendulum here. Yeah. It will require statesmanship and politicians to say exactly what you just said, which is each of these people has a story. Now, how we manage that, how we create safe passages, is a very difficult question. But it is one of the defining issues of the 21st century.
Do you remember, though, that, I mean, has something changed in the last generation? Because, and I'm not talking about, is the next generation more callous or less callous than our generation? But I can remember when I was a kid, the Vietnamese boat people, and that being taken up almost as a national cause, you know, and there seemed to be a great deal of pride about, you know, the fact that Britain had reacted very well and had accepted and welcomed these people in, and then they went on to make a huge contribution, as did, by the way, you know, it's the 75th anniversary of Windrush,
exactly,
you know? So again, another group of people making this progress to the United Kingdom, you know, with great intention and good will. Why don't people these days look at those people on the small boats and think, rather than keep them away, think, oh, they're desperate to come here. How marvellous.
Because they don't see the people. Mm. You know, we don't show pictures of the people in the boats. And I think if they saw the people as people, they would react very differently.
So this is a media failing then, as much, isn't it?
It is. I mean, and you know, one of the reasons Sunak has stuck with Stop the Boats is because it focus groups so well.
Yeah.
But one of the most interesting things, and I remember this from when Labour was in power, their private polling showed that the same respondent in a poll could be vigorously and, you know, aggressively against asylum seekers, because that word had been toxified. That phrase had been toxified. Asylum seekers were very bad people. Yeah. But if you then ask them what you think of refugees, they'd say, oh, it's very important that Britain hold a hand out to refugees. Yeah. And I think that tells you something, which is that the language around this issue has become so aggressive, dehumanised. And, you know, when Suella Braverman says at a Conservative conference that her dream is to see a plane leaving at Heathrow full of refugees who've been deported to Rwanda. That's the dream of a British Home Secretary.
Well, it was more telling than that, even, I think. She said her dream was to see a photograph on the front page of the Daily Telegraph.
Yes, you're right. That's right.
And so this is where, and this, I promise listeners, this is going to be a chronic theme of this podcast, is the corrosive nationalism and the increasing right-wing nature of some of our popular press, and I'll call the Daily Telegraph popular press now because they deploy the same tactics as the Daily Mail, and all in the same boat, to coin an unfortunate phrase. But I do believe that people are much better spirited and much better natured than the media that now peddles them these narratives that are just utterly, utterly corrosive. And probably, to wind back to where we started, you know, were very influential in that bloody referendum vote 7 years ago this week, you know, which got us into this bloody mess in the first place.
I mean, I always start from the position, which is people who say they're against immigration forget the fact that this country made a decision about 70 years ago that it was going to open its doors to many migrants for economic reasons, and it has continued to do so. Why do you think?
Well, the bloody Huguenots in Whitechapel.
It goes back a long time. But yeah, exactly. But I mean, you know, the NHS couldn't have survived without migrant labour. The public services, which is essentially to say the British economy, wouldn't survive without migrant labour. Why is there such a grave labour shortage crisis, which is driving inflation? Yeah. You know, Brexit is one of the reasons. And the other reason is that there is just this pop, you know, that there has been this great surge of undirected, venomous anti-migrant feeling. Again, you need grown-up discussion. You know, leave aside the ethics for a second, just for a thought experiment. Yeah. Just economically, we need migrant labour in a big way. We're not getting it anymore.
Yeah. Listen, just to end on a sort of happy-ish comedic note amongst all the misery, I commend people to listen to the great Stuart Lee's little bit of stand-up around the migrants, Paul Nuttall. If you go onto YouTube,
is this the coming over here?
Bloody beaker people coming over here, bloody earthenware drinking vessels.
Stuart did a musical version of it.
Did he?
With Asian Dub Foundation.
I didn't know that. That's fantastic.
Which is him just standing very laconically at a microphone with Asian Dub Foundation doing this fantastic banger beat behind him.
Brilliant.
He's, you know, coming over here,
bloody Huguenots with their weaving technologies.
Anglo-Saxons.
weaving all that
it
silk.
It is magic. It is absolutely. But it's also very, very true.
It is. Well, let's never forget the potential of new people into our communities rather than the supposed existential threat they bring, which is just total bullshit.
It'd be a bit hard with a surname like mine, really, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, me too, mate. Yeah. We were picking potatoes in Southern Ireland four generations ago. Yeah. What did you want to talk about that we didn't get around to?
Well, as you know, I'm very conscious doing a podcast with you and knowing so little about football.
Yes.
Right? Yep. In an effort to, improve my sort of working knowledge, I went to see Dear England.
How was it?
It's terrific. It's on at the National Theatre. Uh-huh. It just opened this week. I went to see a preview. And it's got Joseph Fiennes, well-known recently in The Handmaid's Tale and further back in Shakespeare in Love, playing Gareth Southgate brilliantly.
Yeah.
And it's about, you know, Southgate's journey and the sort of preparation for Euro next year.
Yeah.
But it's also about Britain and England.
Yes.
And without sort of laying it on too heavily, it explores those themes very cleverly.
Great.
And with great fun. And so you had the whole audience standing up at the end singing Sweet Caroline.
Fantastic.
You know,
I have to say, I think Gareth Southgate is a wholly commendable person.
That comes through, but also what comes through is how there's something very odd going on at the moment. And I've actually written about this in one of my rare forays into the world of association football, which is that during the World Cup, that team became more sort of statesmanlike.
Yeah.
And Southgate became more of a national leader.
Yeah, he did.
Than the hooligans running the country.
He did. But isn't it funny? And it's weird that we've got a crop of people who are, you know, very, very followable in football. You got Lineker, you got Southgate, Gary Neville, you know, you got
Marcus Rashford.
You got people who, you know, football seems to be coming into its own in the sense that there's a recognition that it's a very real part of our national fabric, and these people do have something to say, and you know, they're not all kind of Gaza kind of fools.
Not at all. No, it's very. I mean, I think Southgate actually is a study in leadership. He's a very admirable man.
But we don't have time to talk about that.
But should we talk about another sporting event?
Yes.
Which is Elon Musk.
I know, I've heard.
Versus Mark Zuckerberg.
Cage fighting
in the Vegas Octagon. Now, Mark Zuckerberg has become a fanatical follower of Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is choke holds and strangled. I mean, it's quite and arm locks. You know, it's quite. You have to take it seriously.
Yeah.
And he's quite good. He won a beginner's tournament.
So he's going to kick shit out of Elon Musk.
He's 39 and Musk is, I think, 51 or something like that. And he has no martial arts skill. So my two thoughts is that, first of all, Elon, you know, take care, mate.
Yeah.
You know, don't make two huge mistakes buying Twitter and dying in the same
couple of years. Can you imagine that, actually getting battered by Mark Zuckerberg?
I mean, no. I think if it goes ahead and if it happens...
It won't, will it?
Probably not. No, but I mean, the other thing that made me think was this planet is basically becoming a big bloody playground for billionaires, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, they're having a big competition as to who can get to Mars first.
Yeah.
And now they've decided they're going to find out who's best at fighting, right, in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, that's another thing we've talked about without having time to talk about.
And what else was there? Well, I mean, there's, of course, the small and endlessly comic issue of the coming recession.
Well, one question I've got as a heavily indebted mortgagee is, why is it that mortgage owners are the ones that just by default get hammered? You know, why? Because when they raise interest rates like this deliberately to make sure people have got less money, the only people who are getting hammered are people with mortgages.
On the other hand, just to play devil's advocate for a second, Matt, that I think the renting community would probably be a bit aggrieved if this government threw a lot of money at the mortgage holders. Also, it would completely dampen out. So that's very depressing. But just to, you know, cheer up the nation.
Yeah.
Because God knows we need a little bit of cheer.
Yeah.
You've been out, you know, winning medals, haven't you?
I have today. I won it.
Very day.
I can guarantee. So it was my kid's, my 8-year-old sports day, and there was a parents' relay race, and I was one of the triumphant 8 members of the relay team. Won this gold medal, had a gold medal hung around my neck, and then of course
you posted it to Instagram, and
then
I rushed
to post the picture of me winning this medal on Instagram, and while I was posting the Instagram photo, what I missed was my 8-year-old winning the overall trophy for his year and collecting that trophy. And so I sort of missed that entirely in my awful, awful parenting.
Don't be too tough on yourself. You know, that's national leadership for you. Heavy is the head, Matt. Heavy is the head.
I know.
Now, before we go,
there's something I want to mention. If you're not thoroughly bored of the 7th anniversary of Brexit,
how could you be?
The New European has got a fantastic event. Time on Thursday evening, June the 29th, at Union Chapel in Islington, and it's chaired by a certain Matt D'Ancona.
Hello.
We've got Alistair Campbell, Patience Wheatcroft, Tanit Koch, who was the editor of Bild, the
very fine writer,
big German newspaper, and Bonnie Greer, the wonderful Bonnie Greer.
Oh, great.
So it's going to be a great night, and there's still a few tickets on sale, £15 or £5 concession. So if you're at a loose end on Thursday, please pop
along. Come along.
Yeah, you can buy. You'll find the tickets at the Union Chapel website.
Brilliant.
So that's it for the first issue.
So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Goodbye.